My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and the topic that I'll be touching on tonight is the arms race, and in particular I have a subtitle, The Challenge to North American Christians. And as you'll see after I talk, I put North American Christians in quotes because, well, for a reason that will be clear in a few minutes. It seems to me that in many ways our views about the arms race are shaped by our backgrounds and by our worldviews, and in some situations based on our economic vantage point. Generally, people who are fairly affluent and fairly comfortable are more likely to be in support of an arms race, which they see as part of the national defense of the United States, etc. Whereas people who maybe aren't living as well and have a different view of the economic system might look at it differently. Also, a lot of times my experience in dealing with groups is that it's difficult to talk about the arms race with certain sectors of people. For example, people who are working for defense contractors. There's kind of a natural born or built-in bias against being critical of an arms race because one's livelihood and the well-being of family members that people love is often affected. Or it's hard for people who served in World War II and remember U.S. military kind of strategy in the context of being up against an enemy like Hitler, to think about questions related to the arms race in a new context, in a world that has undergone many, many changes since the 1940s. So our worldview is very important. And one of the things that I'm going to argue is the need to try to let our faith shape some of our thinking about these questions and not let our faith be determined by that worldview that I've been touching on. I wanted to involve you right away, so I'm going to, if you would just help me answer a number of questions. My first question is for you to fill in the blank, and it's my comment is U.S. military spending should be, and you've got a number of choices, much less than it is, about the same as it is, more than it is, and much more than it is. So I'm just going to read it again and maybe you can answer it. U.S. military spending should be much less than it is. How many people feel that way? Fair number. Less? Okay, again, a fair number. About the same? A few? More? Much more. Oh, sorry, I neglected to look up top here. Okay, fair amount of diversity there. Then if you would indicate which statement you agree with more. This is called my worldview exercise. It's trying to get us to think about where we're sitting as we enter this conversation. I'm going to have two statements, and you can evaluate which one you agree with most. First one is, the U.S. is a worldwide defender of freedom and democracy. And the second one is, the U.S. is a worldwide empire, mostly interested in defending its own interests. Okay, so let's make a choice. How many of you would agree most strongly with the first statement? The U.S. is the worldwide defender of freedom and democracy. Okay. How many of you would agree more with the second statement? The worldview that the U.S. is a worldwide empire mostly interested in defending its own interests. Okay.
Okay, isn't there some kind of middle ground there?
Yeah, for sure.
That's what I was looking at. I agree with both statements, actually.
Right. No, and that's why it's which you agree most with, which puts you probably somewhere in between. Okay, third question I would ask is, again, fill in the blank. Civil disobedience for Christians is never justified, rarely justified, or sometimes justified. So let's fill in the blank. Civil disobedience for Christians is never justified. Okay, no one says that. Rarely justified. No one says that. That's pretty amazing. Sometimes justified. Okay. Fourth one. Again, whether you strongly agree with this statement, agree with it, disagree with it, or strongly disagree with it. The way of Jesus is the way of the cross. As followers of Jesus, we should be committed to nonviolence. How many of you would strongly agree with that? How many of you would agree with it? How many of you would disagree with it? How many of you would strongly disagree with it? Okay. And then this is more of a short discussion item before I lead into some presentation, but I would be interested in us in a brainstorm fashion, meaning just kind of throwing out some ideas, some of your opinions about two more questions. What do you see are the things that are posing the gravest threats to United States security? What are some of the things that we see are posing the greatest threats to U.S. security? And let's just, again, brainstorm means that not a lot of debate, but we're just going to throw out some ideas. Anybody?
Cutting off our oil supply.
Cutting off the oil supply.
Militarism.
Yes.
Colonel North.
Oliver North.
Militarism.
Militarism itself. Others?
Separation in class between the ruling bodies and the people themselves.
Okay, so widening gap between the people and
people
upper class sectors. What's that?
People selling us out, our own people selling us out, like the Walker family.
Okay, own people selling us out, and you're talking about a spy scandal, the Walker family.
Third world debt.
The third world debt. Okay, then how about this question? What conditions or what governmental policies would in your mind justify your participation in civil disobedience? In other words, what would a government need to do, or what would the situation be in this country for you to personally engage in civil disobedience? If anybody would just, again, throw it out kind of a brainstorm fashion.
I'd be willing to just have some disobedience against our entire Congress the way they operate.
Okay, sometimes it's the frustration with the way that the U.S. Congress is operating. Yes?
It would be my right to worship, religious right.
If they would impede your religious right to worship.
Current $300 billion budget.
A current $300 billion budget.
The current Central American policy.
Current Central America policy.
Especially when a Democratic vote indicates a majority of people are against aid to the Congress.
Okay, so when the Congress clearly does not reflect the will of the people, which you're saying in relation to the Central America policy, consistently majority of people say no, but the policy goes on.
When the president doesn't reflect the interests of the people.
Okay, when the president doesn't reflect the interests of the people. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I did that just as a background to help us try to think about some of our own worldview. And I want to move on now and just give a hopefully reasonably brief presentation touching on some biblical issues, at least that I see in relation to the arms race. And then also just some kind of practical observations or interpretations, my own analysis of what's going on with the arms race, and then we'll have some time for discussion. My first biblical observation is one that the early church made, and that is that the statement that Christ is Lord. The early church tried to be very clear about that the ultimate allegiance of Christians is to Christ. In a very similar way, the first commandment in the Old Testament says, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." Not money gods, not nationalistic gods, not governmental gods, that Christ is Lord. Now, it seems to me that that's very important within this culture, because one of the biggest religious problems that I feel that we face as Christians living in this country is that we oftentimes confuse our faith with patriotism, confuse our faith with nationalistic symbols and values. and that we have been, as all, as happens in all societies, we have been socialized to believe that we are different. So that somehow what we're, the way that the issues are oftentimes posed is it's the United States in defense of freedom and democracy versus the evil Soviet Empire. Now, we could all point to some fairly horrendous activities by the Soviet Union, but we tend to be blinded by the, those that are closest to home. So socialization, nationalism can in fact get in the way of what I see as a fundamental affirmation as we approach issues of security, of global as well as national security. And that is, and this is where I qualify the title of my talk tonight, that I think it's very important that we state that we are not U.S. Christians. We are not North American Christians. We are Christians that either through God's design or accident of fate have happened to be born in the United States of America. And that our fundamental allegiance is to God and to sort out what does it mean for us to be faithful as Christians in the world living by accident of birth in the United States of America. Nation states have a way of demanding ultimate allegiances. And in this country that happens in many subtle ways. We have to be very concerned about that as we examine the arms race and its implications. Second observation is that as Christians, we are to be committed to the well-being of the broader family of God and not just the nuclear family. Again, another one of our idolatries, it seems to me, in this culture is that we pay so much attention on the well-being of our individual families. Now, don't get me wrong. We also live in a culture that abuses our individual families. We have a lot of child abuse, a lot of spouse abuse, a lot of interfamiliar problems. But the point I'm trying to make here is that as Christians, we affirm really our citizenship in the kingdom of God, and our family becomes all people. And one of the examples I sometimes give of the problem of focusing on the nuclear family in a very narrow way is a typical U.S. Christmas. The statistics I have are for 1983. In 1983, U.S. citizens spent $125 billion for their Christmas on presents for each other. That's equal to twice as much money as the gross national products of the 31 poorest countries in the world, with 287 million people living within them. And then again, to take it a step further, very few of us would walk outside of our door on our way to buy a color television set if our actual blood brother or sister or mother or father were starving and we walked right by them and saw them. We wouldn't do that, would we? And yet, the nature of things and the nature of the way we've structured our lives and the nature of the way that we think about our allegiances and our families is that we, in fact, do that almost every day. In other words, we ignore the interests of the broad family of God that we are intimately bound to through the body of Christ. One other thing about the nuclear family as it relates to the arms race. In my experience of talking with people, I sense two very different responses based on people's loving involvement with their own immediate families. One kind of response is what I call a defensive response. And that is people are saying, I've worked hard for what I've got, and I'm going to protect the interests of my family, and if we need to spend $300 billion or $400 billion, we're going to do it because I want my son and daughter to be secure. That in many ways was the option that my parents chose. They chose to raise me in a suburb because they didn't want to deal with poverty problems, they didn't want to deal with race problems, they didn't want to deal with world problems, they wanted to insulate me from. So one problem with the love that we have with our nuclear families, our immediate families, is it can lead to that kind of defensive posture that separates us from the broader family of God. But I've seen it work just the opposite way over and over. During the 2 years that Sarah and I were working in Central America, we saw many, many people come through. And oftentimes, the people who felt the pain of Central America and got to the heart of the issues and understood the absolute inhumanity and disaster of the U.S. policy throughout the region were the people who started to live the experience through their feelings for their own children. Because everywhere you go in Central America, you see the children. Beautiful, beautiful children. Many of them malnourished, many of them poor, many of them without schools. And they started to live their experience in Central America by thinking about their feelings in that context for their own families. So it can work in a variety of ways. Third biblical insight for me is the clear biblical affirmation that the kingdom of God is separate from any nation state. Now that was fairly clear early on in Israel's history. When the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt, and you have the Exodus story, and God helps liberate the people, and they enter the wilderness, and they're wandering for 40 years, it was very clear that the kingdom of God wasn't associated with a place. It was associated with God's initiative and a people trying to live in response to that initiative. But when the people entered the land and they became the state of Israel, there was a lot of confusion. And in fact, the people of Israel began to think, we're God's chosen people. We're God's chosen nation. Nothing is ever going to go wrong with us because God has chosen us. Well, obviously that got shattered by the exile, when the people lost the land because of their disobedience, because of their injustice, and particularly the prophets say, because of their injustice to the poor. Jesus seems to follow along pretty clearly with an understanding that the kingdom of God is associated with God and God's people and not a place. Because one of the most common messianic expectations, the expectation of what would a Messiah look like, was they were expecting a political leader who was going to come in and restore Israel to its place of power in the world. And Jesus rejected that. In favor of a ministry that served the poor, announced freedom to the oppressed, and in very specific and concrete ways, challenged the powerful of his time, religious and political leaders. So, again, the point here, there are dangers because the vast majority of Christians in this culture, in this country, perceive that the United States is God's chosen nation, that we are God's chosen people, and we are up against an evil empire, and our weapons and our military and economic power are things that we must use in preservation of that freedom, that democracy, and all the other rhetoric that we use about ourselves. A fourth biblical insight is its view of government. It seems to me that the biblical writers are fairly clear that government is better than anarchy. In other words, I think it's legitimate to say that government is a gift from God. That's a very different thing than saying that Christians must be obedient to all governments, or that Christians must be obedient in the face of all governmental policies and actions. Again, the fundamental affirmation is that Christ is Lord, so we don't give up our ultimate allegiances to states and nations and governments. The most simple example, and it's an example I use in this book, if anybody wants to deal with this in more detail, a book, it's my book, it's called The Politics of Compassion. And I give the example in there to illustrate the point I'm trying to make. Imagine that we had one well for this community, a small well, and that there were no plans made for how to use that well. It would be rather chaotic. We'd all be trying to go there probably at the same time. We might end up fighting over who gets water at 8 a.m. and who has to get it at 1 a.m. So if in that situation we decided we should really manage the use of this well. And to do so, we would elect 10 representatives from this community, this room, to manage the use of the well, collect taxes so that it could function, etc. And that we all agreed to do that, and we elected the 10, and they did that. I think that's pretty consistent with the biblical word, which is that government and management of that well is better than anarchy. However, if the 10 people that we elected to manage that well decided on their own that they were going to kill and drown all children with dimples. Would we obey that? I don't think we would, and we shouldn't. The biblical message at that point is that when unjust policies of a government get in the way of God's kingdom, values, love, justice, it is our obligation to go against those laws. If we don't do that, then what we've done is we've given up our authority. Then we're guilty of idolatry because we're saying Christ isn't Lord, an unjust government is Lord. A fifth observation, and I think this is maybe one of the most important ones for me as I think about the arms race, is the biblical observation that security is more than military power. And that in fact, military power can undermine security. A reliance upon military power can actually undermine rather than enhance security. And I would call your attention to several passages that I'll just mention. I won't read all of them. But Amos and Hosea, two prophets, talk about this very well. And one thing you might want to look at is Amos 3, verses 10 through 11, in which Amos basically says, you're storing up violence and you're trying to protect them unjustly through military power, therefore you will be destroyed. Or in the case of Hosea, chapter 10, verses 12 through 14, Hosea says at the end, and I believe it's verse 14, it's because you trust in your chariots, the most modern weapon system of the time, and the multitude of your warriors, therefore the tumult of war shall arise among your people and all your fortresses will be destroyed. So the biblical writers suggest that an over-reliance upon military power for security will undermine our security. And what they say is that security is dependent upon shalom. Now we translate shalom as peace, but it really has a deeper biblical meaning. What it means, what shalom implies, is the economic and spiritual health of people and of communities of people. Okay, a sixth observation, my final biblical observation, is the example of Jesus raises, it seems to me, profound problems for me and probably for many of us. Because Jesus seemed to adopt a stance of nonviolent resistance to evil. Jesus was not passive in the face of evil. Jesus resisted evil, but he seems to be willing to do a number of things, to absorb the consequences of injustice into his own person, to absorb unjust suffering into his own person rather than inflict it on others. He was willing to confront evil. He was willing to confront the rich. He was willing to confront the powerful and basically pay the consequences. Now, that's hard. The reason this is hard for me is that, and I think maybe for many of us, when you think of that option, the example of Jesus, it's hard to think about situations like Hitler in Nazi Germany. Could Hitler have been stopped in a massive nonviolent mobilization? I don't know. More closely to home for me, having lived in Central America for the last 2 years, I believe that if the Nicaraguan government were not defending itself militarily, the United States would have destroyed it within weeks. Within weeks. So how do we live with that tension? But the last thing that I would point out are two more quick things here related to Jesus in the New Testament and the biblical messages. The biblical message has a much broader understanding of violence than we have. We generally associate violence. If I take out a gun and shoot Frank, that's violence. But what we don't count as violence, and the biblical writers do, is that hunger is violence. Poverty is violence. When 2 or 3% of the people control the land so that others starve, that's violence. That's what our Latin American brothers and sisters call the institutionalization of violence. So that as Christians, it seems to me, whether we decide to resist evil in a violent fashion or a nonviolent fashion is a very, very important question. But if we're to deal with that question in appropriate ways, we have to be willing to try to look at violence in a broader way. Because in many ways, none of us, in my view at least, none of us has a nonviolent option. Because we are all the beneficiaries of an international economy that is structured in a way that does violence to the poor. And we all participate in that. Now, that's not a plea for guilt and for immobilization. It's, I think, relatively a statement of fact that just says that's what we're up against. And we need to, in the words of Dom Helder Camara, we need to try to break the cycle of violence. Camara is a Brazilian bishop who says, he describes the cycle of violence in this way. He said the first violence is poverty, hunger, oppression that's inflicted on the poor. The second cycle of violence is when the poor rise up in anguish against those unjust structures and try to change them. And the third cycle of violence in the cycle of violence is when the rich and powerful use force to maintain that system. So he says if we want to break the cycle of violence, we better deal with that injustice, which is really the ground seed. Okay, some interpretation and then we'll have the rest of the time for discussion. Just to tell you, my perspective on this, the things that I'm sharing with you now and have shared, flow out of the last 15 years of my life. And the last 15 years of my life and probably the next 30 or 35 or however many years I live will probably be in a similar place of dealing with issues of hunger and poverty, the political and economic causes of hunger, etc. And most recently, I come out of living 2 years in Central America and witnessing the United States policy of seeking military solutions to what are fundamentally deep-seated economic injustice type problems. Okay, if we look around the world, we see, if we look at it honestly, it seems to me, we see the absence of shalom. Again, I define shalom in terms of economic and spiritual health. We have a relatively small group of people living in the United States and Western Europe and Japan who utilize an inordinate amount of the world's resources, are living very well, very comfortably. We see the majority of people in the world living in conditions that we can hardly imagine. In the case of Central America, if you go to a country like El Salvador or Guatemala or Honduras, you will see that land is owned by 2 or 3% of the people. You will see the vast majority of people without health care, without education, without land, without opportunity, basically. They see, they say in places like Guatemala that in rural areas, half the children die before the age of 5. So we see a lot of absence of shalom. We see an international economy that, in my view, is structured in ways that automatically victimizes the poor. Now, why do I say that? I say that because the international economy, as it functions, is based on the purchasing power of the rich and based on the corporate profit desires of the rich. We don't produce things based on their need. We produce them based on their market demand. And what that means is the way the international economy functions is that people with money, whether they live in the United States or Canada or Guatemala or El Salvador, are part of an international supermarket. And they produce and they consume within the framework of that supermarket. But the poor are victims of that. Now, the reason that's a background for me about raising questions about the arms race is I think it can be argued that each nation has the right to some measure of military defense. But I think if we examine very closely U.S. foreign policies, U.S. military policies, the kinds of weapons that are being produced and utilized, then more often than not, the purpose of those foreign policies are not to protect legitimate defense interests. They are, in fact, to protect unjust privileges, to prevent land reform in Central America, to prevent the restructuring of economies that simply have to take place all over the world, at least the underdeveloped world, if poor people are going to eat. Another observation, again my own interpretation, is we can look at the arms race as the world's leading killer. The leading cause of hunger is the arms race. Whether weapons are used or not used, the resources that are wasted in military production, both material and human resources. I'll give you one example. The United Nations, we're right in the middle of the United Nations decade on clean water. How many people knew that? Anybody know that? Two people, a couple of people. That's very high. This must be an extremely sophisticated group. It's very high. Usually in an audience of 200 people, you may have one person in the United States that knows that this is the United Nations decade for clean water. It's estimated that to provide every single person in the world with safe water to drink that would cut infant mortality by at least a half would cost $300 billion over a 10-year period. Now, as Frank mentioned, $300 billion is approximately equal to this year's U.S. military budget. Now the question is, what would make the world more secure? An arms race out of control, or in fact providing people with clean water. Now, I sometimes say this jokingly, but I say it in half seriousness, that it's my belief that when we have the next debate about what level of military defense this country needs, we should first have every congressperson and the president and all senators spend a couple nights in the South Bronx. Then we'll fly them to Central America. I will personally arrange to provide them with a water jug. And they can put the water jug on top of their heads and they can walk for 5 or 7 or 10 miles to a river. And they can dig out, probably literally, dig out some water that will be more mud or as much mud as water. Then we'll carry it back to our meeting site. We'll drink the water. We'll wait 24, 48 hours for the amoebas to set in, and then we'll have our debate. Then we'll have our debate. That would be a much more biblical way of looking at these issues, to try to understand from the perspective of the victims. And that trade-off is very real. Sarah has done a lot of work with water projects and other things. We have very good medical friends who have been working in Nicaragua related to water projects. Those trade-offs are very, very real. Another statistic I'll give you is that in the United States right now, 1 out of 4 U.S. children is born into poverty. That to me is just amazing. 1 out of every 4 U.S. children is now born into poverty in this country. That again raises the question about the priority of an arms race. Another observation. The impact that the arms race is having on the U.S. and some of the ways that it's undermining security. One of those ways is that military spending is a tremendous source of unemployment. Now, that goes against the common notion, because the common notion, which is also true, by the way, is that millions of U.S. people are dependent upon military employment to feed their families. In fact, the U.S. government for years and years and years has been using, and the Reagan administration is using, a tremendous influx of money into the military sectors to try to stimulate the economy, right? But the problem is that military spending is a terrible job creator. It creates very few jobs per $1 billion spent. And when you compare it to other job options, whether it be teachers or building houses or other kinds of things, you would create many, many, many more jobs per $1 billion spent. The other problem is, maybe you've been reading, there's a new code word in the U.S. paper, a new word that's very common to be talked about right now. It's called Restoring America's Competitive Edge. Well, it's my belief, and the belief of a lot of other people, that the reason that the United States is no longer competitive against our Western European and Japanese and other allies is that the United States has militarized its economy to the point where we simply are investing so much in non-productive growth that we are debilitating. We are destroying the economy from within. We are undermining, if we view economic health as vital to shalom and security, we're literally eating ourselves alive. And one of the things that's gone without much notice is that in the last 4 to 5 years, the United States has now moved from being the world's largest creditor country, meaning we had the most money available for loans, investment, etc., to being the world's largest debtor country. And the two countries we think of as being the most indebted are Brazil and Mexico. The U.S. debt is now greater than those two countries combined. So we're destroying ourselves from within. Now, one of the questions is, why do we do that? Well, one more thing about magnitude. 1945 to 1980, the U.S. spent $2 trillion for military spending. 1945 to 1980. Between 1985 and 1989, we will spend $2 trillion more. So in a 5-year period, we're going to spend the $2 trillion. Now, just to give you, we can't imagine what $1 trillion is. So I did this, and this is also in the book. And this is a 1984 example. The national debt of the United States was $1.5 trillion in 1984. So I feel that's how much we owe to ourselves, because government spends more than we take in taxes. This is not including interest now, these calculations, but if we were to balance that budget, meaning all of a sudden we would now only spend, the government would only spend as much as it received in taxes, and we were to start paying off that $1.5 trillion, if we paid it off $1 million a day, excluding interest, $1 million a day, we would pay off that $1.5 trillion in the year 6,093. That's 4,110 years. If, on the other hand, we would have reduced the U.S. military budget in half, we would have paid it off by 1992. Now, just to give you an idea of the magnitude. Okay, one of the questions is, why do we do it? Why do we spend all this money? Again, some people would argue, if we have to spend it to defend legitimate interests, we should do it. I don't believe that's what we're doing. And I would say that a lot of our military spending, a lot of our military policy, we see it in Central America, we see it in many other areas of the world, is destined to be used to try to protect what I call unjust privileges that keep poor people poor, that keep any restructuring of an international economy that would improve the lives of the vast majority of people who are suffering in underdeveloped countries. A second reason that we do it is because it's very profitable. The arms race is very, very profitable. And in fact, according to our own government studies, U.S. military contractors earn on average twice the profits of civilian industries. And so you see, for example, in Minnesota, where we're from, that Honeywell continues to sell off more and more of its non-military production and buy up more and more military production units. Why? Because they earn twice the profits on those military production than they do on civilian. We need, I think, to come to terms with the fact that the arms race is being fueled because of its profitability, even though it undermines shalom, undermines security of all of us, undermines security of people in Central America and elsewhere. And the greatest boondoggle that we're facing, in my opinion, right now is Star Wars. Why are we promoting Star Wars? Star Wars is an empty promise. That's a quotation from the best scientists in the country. Why are we pursuing Star Wars? Because it's incredible. It opens, it opens up the possibility of incredible corporate profits. It feeds the idea of let's seek a technological solution for what are fundamentally, again, social, economic, and spiritual problems. Okay, implications, then discussion. Implications. It seems to me we need to, as we think about this question of the arms race, we have to confront what I call the trinity of idolatry that we face as citizens of this country. What makes up that trinity for me is militarism, nationalism, and affluence. That if we are to free ourselves and affirm that Christ is Lord, we're going to have to confront those idols. Robert McAfee Brown, a theologian that maybe some of you have heard of, he's a Presbyterian, one of the most probably well-known theologians in the country. He said, he wrote recently, that the failure of the church in Nazi Germany was the failure to speak out. It was so enculturated into the dominant culture that during the rise of Hitler, it didn't say anything. And the few people that did finally speak out spoke out so late that the only choice before them was the choice of martyrdom. Robert McAfee Brown says, and I would agree with this, that while it may be inappropriate to make direct parallels between Nazi Germany and the United States of America in 1987, that the signs of national idolatry are everywhere and clear, and that now is the time for Christians to begin acting in ways so that we don't repeat the failure of Nazi Germany. Be quiet, remain silent, remain passive in the face of an arms race, in the face of an illegal foreign policy, in the face of all kinds of problems. If we do that, we're almost guaranteeing our own destruction. So I think it's time for things like tax resistance for Christians. It's time for Christians to carve out independent lifestyles that are more simple, more responsible use of resources, and that can be models for other people as we approach living in a world that's going to be very different from the one that we're now in. It involves political action for me, political action in terms of appeals to government officials, in terms of demonstrations, and in terms at times of even civil disobedience. It implies for me the careful selection and evaluation of our jobs, of whether our jobs in fact are feeding a military monster or whether they in fact are feeding the human community. I think it's time for Christians to withdraw from, this is a very radical statement, I get in trouble all the time, but I'll say it anyway, to withdraw from and refuse induction to the military service in the United States in these times. And I think it's a time for community building and for prayer. My last comment is, what I try to stress with people is, based on my time in Central America and many of the issues I've touched on, these are not normal times. I think one of the big dangers is we're treating them as relatively normal times. And they're not normal times. What we're seeing at the level of U.S. governmental policy in these times are frightening. And they're frightening not only because of what happens to people in Central America, which is very important to me, and Sarah and I are going to be giving a presentation on our experiences in Central America later in the week, but also because we're seeing the erosion of our own freedoms and our own democracy. Okay, we've got about 20 minutes for discussion. Yes.
I have a question to the last point you mentioned about what Christians can do and should do. I wonder, after the experience of living in this country for almost a year, why you don't manage to use the democratic structures you have.
Yeah.
That seems to me very important because, for example, I see not much difference between the Democrats and Republicans. And I don't see much political awareness of people. And I don't see much interest in politics at all among the people. And I wonder if most people agree with their government or not. Most people I met agree with the government. So I think that is much more important than civil disobedience or demonstrations to build a political awareness and use the democratic structures you have.
I'll try to summarize that because this is being taped, but just the question was, why don't we say more about involving ourselves in the political process and utilizing the democratic structures that we have, because you're speaking as a someone from East Germany, right? And you're saying that you don't see a lot of political involvement, you don't see much difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, and that clearly is a very important arena, probably more important than civil disobedience and other kinds of demonstrations. Yeah, well, I strongly encourage people to be involved in the political process. One of the problems that we have with our political process is that there is such a slight difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. There are differences, but the way that our democratic structure is structured, it's very difficult for a third party to function in this country. It's very difficult. For example, the way the Nicaraguan elections were structured in 1984 is they were structured in ways that small parties that got votes were assured representation by the number of votes that they got. It was structured in a way that allowed for really the most democratic participation. Our system is not structured that way, so we end up with two political parties that have marginal differences. So we probably need the creation of a strong, clearly articulated third party or a variety of parties that can force or push a real differences in issues that we don't get at the present time. And I think one of the reasons that we've seen so many people drop out of the legislative process in the United States, so that we only have, what, in the last presidential election, which was supposed to be a good one, what was it? 30% of the population, eligible population, voted. One of the reasons you have such a high withdrawal rate is because a feeling that you're voting for two parties and it doesn't really address interests. That's one reason. So it's very, very important, and that is a long-term difficult strategy of building alternative political organizations and probably a new party.
It's also probably not fair to say that civil disobedience and dissent is not part of the democratic political process in this country, because it certainly is. And the way we do it, and if you look at every major social evolutionary progress that we've made in the last 200 years, women's vote, civil rights, slaves, labor, farm, whatever, anything that's come to the fore and eventually became legislated began initially by dissent, civil disobedience, and protest. That's how we do it in this country.
Yeah, civil disobedience has been a very important push to the political process to force changes. So here it is. It has been historically very important. Yes.
One of the things that you were talking about was how we are making new poor, in a sense, in this country, how more people are becoming more hungrier. And one of the things that has been brought up around the world is how the soldiers are oppressing their own people by trying to keep up with this arms race, and the people there are getting less and less. While there is a small segment of the population there that also gets more and more, and the arms race seems bigger and bigger to them. The same thing's happening in China. And what one of the things that was brought to my attention was that when countries start this, they stop becoming world powers and start succumbing to the smaller nations.
I'll try to again paraphrase that in a shorter way, but basically I think the comment was that the victims of the arms race is a widening circle within the United States, that we have more and more poor. That's also true in other places, including the Soviet Union, that the arms race is taking a very severe toll on the economy and the people, etc., and you noted China as well. Yeah, I think the problem that, as I see it from my U.S. lens, is, and I've heard a number of U.S. leaders talk about this, is they say, okay, well, maybe military spending isn't the greatest thing for our economy, but it's a good way to keep pressure on the Soviet Union to force them to divert resources. In other words, it's a form of economic pressure against the Soviet Union, etc. Well, as long as you have that as a perspective, it's very dangerous, because it seems to me that we have, there is a new leader in the Soviet Union who understands pretty well that militarism is very harmful to the Soviet Union's economy and wants to make some changes. And as a result of that, the Soviet Union did a number of things. It engaged, for example, in a 18-month unilateral moratorium to stop nuclear testing, underground testing, and said that we will carry that on as if the United States will just join us in this, we can begin reversing the arms race. Well, the Reagan administration had no commitment to that. We've seen a number of overtures, it seems to me, coming out of that perspective from the Soviet Union, that their economy is not going to improve without. Now, just one other observation about this. At some point, while I'm here in the village, I would like to give a presentation on low-intensity conflict. I won't go into too much of that now, but basically that's the strategy of counter-revolutionary warfare that the United States is utilizing throughout Central America, throughout parts of Africa, basically to try to control events in third world countries. Well, part of the logic of low-intensity conflict that's being played out in Nicaragua, for example, is that you redefine victory. And victory doesn't necessarily have to mean, for example, in the case of the United States and Nicaragua, obviously our policymakers would love to see the Nicaraguan government overthrown and a government much more favorable to the United States put in power. That's one definition of victory. But another definition of victory is simply to inflict suffering on the Nicaraguan people, force the Nicaraguan government to divert resources from healthcare, from education, from land reform, from development, back into warfare, to prevent revolution from succeeding. So the United States seems to me more determined than I'm aware of in other points of our history in utilizing warfare as a means of economic destabilization against the socialist countries as well as against third world countries that are trying to bring about internal changes. That puts the focus back on us, that we've got to start communicating different messages to our leaders and coming up with different priorities, because those are very, very disastrous priorities. And I think that there's a hope for that, perhaps, out of the incredible destruction that we're seeing or damage done to our own economy because of the arms race. It certainly is a time when we should be talking about that and pushing those issues.
How about yes. The high cost of running for political office and PACs and special interest money that makes democracy tend to fail?
I remember a number of years ago being fairly alarmed. The question was basically the high cost of running for political office and the influence of PAC committees. Of being alarmed a number of years ago when I heard that there are two basically Pentagon lobbyists for every congressperson. And that's not counting the lobbyists of GE, Honeywell, and all of those who are lobbying for increased military spending. So the influence of power blocks of people that have a stake in the arms race is one of the things that fuels it. Another thing that's alarming is I heard recently that two-thirds of the U.S. Senate is made up of millionaires, for example. Two-thirds of the people in the Senate. Now, as a biblical person, I believe very, very strongly that the biblical writers are pretty clear that the voices of the poor need to be heard, and that poor people need to be empowered, and that evangelization in today's world probably means for us learning how to listen and learn from the situation of victims, of poor people, of their struggles, etc. And that's one of the things that happens if you visit Central America, at least can happen. That's not going to happen when you've got two-thirds of your senators being millionaires. So the cost of running for political office, the worldview that comes with that kind of wealth and power of the politicians who are running make it very, very difficult. Now, I don't know where to run with that in terms of the implications other than saying that there probably needs to be a tremendous amount of grassroots mobilization if we're going to bring about structural changes. Got time for a couple more. First, if anybody else who hasn't asked one has one or a comment. Yes?
I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit more on the politics of compassion. Like, I know you do in your book, and I'd like to read that, but just briefly, because I struggle with our involvement. How do I, as an individual, become involved with the government when actually I've become so involved now with fringe things or what they would call counterculture stuff that I'm, you know, people like in Sojourners communities, I mean, they are actually being harassed by the government now. It seems like the democratic process has no longer now looked at people with alternative views as credible. And whether we come from a Christian perspective, because Christ is Lord for me, or whether people are in the New Age movement or any other movement who are speaking for disarmament or the peace movement, there's a struggle because our government is viewing all of those people as, in some way, counter to American freedom and democracy, and it makes involvement very difficult unless protests and demonstrations and civil disobedience is then the best way for us. Politics of compassion, I mean, how do we respond in a compassionate way?
Okay, I'll just summarize that with the last part of the question and the first part, which was just to elaborate a little bit on what I mean by a politics of compassion. I am going to lead a couple of Bible studies this week, and one of them I'm going to try to do on compassion. But I will say just a few things now. I chose the title of the book, The Politics of Compassion, because it seems to me that we have a number of problems. One problem is that for many of us, we're just kind of indifferent, or at least for many of our people, and I'll include myself and others in it. A lot of times, we don't really have to care about a lot of issues. One of the striking things about coming back from Central America and living there for 2 years about back in the U.S. is all the issues that we regarded as important in life and death were basically optional for many, many, many people in this culture. And the culture is designed to help people opt out from video games and music and football and baseball, and we can name a million things that we can interest ourselves in that we don't have to. So that's one problem. A second problem is that if we are concerned, then we obviously need to be concerned about immediate needs of people. In the case of, Sarah and I just spoke out in Cleveland, and we were with a group that for 10 years has been operating in a very poor area of Cleveland, dealing with people who have been let out of mental institutions because of budget cuts, dealing with drug addicts, dealing with people with all kinds of problems. And obviously those needs are important, and to not address them is a tragedy. That's not compassionate either. But to talk about the politics of compassion is to recognize that many of the problems that we face, whether it be poverty or hunger or homelessness, will ultimately only be solved if we restructure society in ways that will respond to that. So that means involvement in the political process. And it means involvement in the electoral process. It means involvement in demonstrations. It means involvement in all kinds of things. But I think, you know, we can't say too much about that now, but the idea for me is that we need to strategize. We need to understand that political change is important if we, in fact, are to have a more compassionate society. That a government policy that hurts people can undo all kinds of individual compassion. So, just we need to set our agenda with that in mind, and obviously that doesn't mean ignoring individual needs or victims, but it means we must be building community, building political movements as we do our work. Otherwise, we'll just be stuck in a rut. Okay, I think we have to stop, but we can. Anybody who wants to talk about this more individually with me, I'm willing to do that, and also we'll come across some of similar issues later in the week. Thank you.